In many whistleblowing cases, the highest stakes are for national security whistleblowing. It takes a great deal of fortitude to take on the power and the authority of the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, and in some cases, the White House itself. Oftentimes, the whistleblower pays with his career, and in some cases, with his freedom. I'm John Kiriakou, and you're watching The Whistleblowers. In many whistleblowing cases, the highest stakes are for national security whistleblowing. It takes a great deal of fortitude to take on the power and the authority of the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, and in some cases, the White House itself. Oftentimes, the whistleblower pays with his career and in some cases, with his freedom. National security whistleblowers are often under more scrutiny than corporate or other governmental whistleblowers because of the presence of classified information, covert programs, or sources and methods in their whistleblowing. It's one thing to speak truth to power, but it's an entirely different thing to speak truth to power, to be fired from your job, to be prosecuted under the Espionage Act for it, and even to go to prison, even when you know that what you did was right. Just ask Chelsea Manning, Jesselyn Radack, reality winner Jeffrey Sterling, Daniel Hale, or Edward Snowden. I can tell you the same story. Our guest today has had that very same experience. He valued his oath to the Constitution and he paid for it with his career. At the same time, he nearly lost his freedom. Tom Drake was a senior NSA officer who blew the whistle on NSA's dragnet surveillance of Americans in the immediate aftermath of the September 11th attacks. He was fired, arrested, prosecuted, and exonerated. And he has become one of the most important and outspoken supporters of national security whistleblowers in America. Tom, welcome to the show. Tom, for those of our viewers who don't know you, you were one of the first national security whistleblowers following Daniel Ellsberg's release of the Pentagon Papers way back in 1970. I don't believe that it's possible to overestimate the importance of what you told the American people. Your story starts on September 11th, 2001. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, that was my first actual day reporting to my new duty station. Of course, I didn't know when I arrived at ODARC 30 at NSA headquarters at Fort Meade, Maryland, that the events of the day would unfold as they did. And so the horror of the towers coming down and the Pentagon attack, it's a frozen day. I know exactly where I was and what I was doing, especially since it was my first actual day on the job. But then it became clear within just a few days of 9/11 that the failure to keep people out of harm's way was used as an excuse to massively erode the Fourth Amendment rights of U.S. citizens and others. And then billions of dollars in fraud and waste, as well as a cover-up of what turned out to be some really critical 9/11 intelligence failures. All that unfolded within weeks of 9/11.
And then really immediately after 9/11, you realized that something was very wrong. You realized that while NSA had access to a new program that could have kept us safe at a reasonable price, I might add, they decided to go with something that allowed dragnet surveillance, even of American citizens. Tell us about that.
Well, it's quite the historical irony because of abuses in the past. And this is something NSA is, they don't like to talk about their abuses from the 50s, 60s, and 70s under the cloak and banner of national security and secrecy. In fact, they're actually embarrassed by it. But it all came out in the 1970s when I was a teenager, and I certainly was well aware of all the hearings that took place, particularly in Congress. In fact, people were finding out that there was even an NSA that existed for the very first time, a super secret agency. So here we are, 9/11 just unleashed all that. It was just, there was no guardrails. It was like, hey, you know, we can just collect it all. Why not? Let's start doing it because we don't know where the next threat's coming from. And it's understandable in that panic, right? The panic of when would the next attack occur, that they would be incentivized, and I'm gonna say that, incentivized to bypass the Fourth Amendment and the existing statute at the time, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which was actually passed in 1978, as a consequence of all of the abuses that had unfolded during those hearings in the 1970s.
When you saw this evidence of wrongdoing at NSA, you went through your chain of command, which is what we're all taught to do when we first enter into governmental service. In fact, you stuck closely to your chain of command. When you saw that NSA was breaking the law, you went to your superiors, you went to the inspector general, you went to the Pentagon's inspector general, because NSA is an adjunct of the Defense Department, and then you went to the Congressional Oversight Committee. Now, that is exactly what we're told to do. And they ended up rewarding you with more than a half a dozen felony charges, including more than several counts of espionage. Of course, you hadn't committed espionage, and those charges were all dropped. But this is what national security agencies do. Is there any way to explain why this was the course of events in your case? Because you went through the chain of command. Why weren't your complaints addressed and investigated?
Because there was an active cover-up of just how far we had gone off the rails in terms of the law and the Constitution and the protections afforded by the Fourth Amendment. And in the secret world, it was FISA. The U.S. citizens, U.S. corporations, and what they call resident aliens, resident foreigners, were protected by the Fourth Amendment. And they made a decision at the highest level, up to and including the President of the United States, to authorize bypassing all that. And so they were in direct violation of the law. They knew it, but they actively covered it up. It was one of the deepest of the deep secrets of the national security establishment, all the way up to and including President Bush and Vice President Cheney.
Now, it's a part even of NSA's charter that it's not permitted to spy on American citizens or U.S. persons, anybody even in the United States on a green card. But they do that every day anyway. How is that?
Yeah, because they get away with it.
Yeah, that's what it is.
See, this is the reality is, and a lot of people just, well, how could they just break the law when there was laws against breaking the law? But they did it anyways because they could, and they had top cover. They had the president authorizing this in his super secret memo, that the only copy that existed was in the chief of staff's office, and in fact, in his safe, David Addington, who was chief of staff to then Vice President Cheney. That was the only copy. It was that secret.
Insane. Were you ever given?
Yeah, truly insane.
It really is. It's just an obvious violation of the law.
But see, the violation of law, in essence, national security took priority. National security was. They weren't going to let the Constitution get in the way. I was actually told that. It was a quaint document that FISA couldn't keep up with the times. I heard exigent conditions. You don't understand, Mr. Drake. Because I said, what are we doing violating the law? And if, remember, we go back to Congress, and I was actually told by the chief counsel in the general counsel's office that if we go to Congress with what we want to do, they'll say no. Now, this is right after 9/11. This is before the Patriot Act was passed.
Wow.
Which in itself really pushed the boundaries.
Yes, it did.
But at least it was legislation formulated by Congress, right? And then signed into law by the president. This is before that. This is that period before that. And so, yeah, it's quite something. And you can imagine, knowing they're violating the law willfully and deliberately, that they're going to have to cover it up. That's, again, one of the realities of a secrecy regime. You're incentivized to keep hidden what you're actually doing, and the secrecy system permits it.
When I was at the CIA in the immediate aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, our director for counterterrorism said very plainly, we're going to start killing people, lots of people. And I remember thinking, well, that's against the law. We're not supposed to be able to kill people. Yeah. And a colleague of mine said, oh, the law will catch up to us. Meaning, we'll change the law to allow us to kill people, not the law will catch up to us. If we kill people, we'll be prosecuted for it. And I think the same thing happened at NSA. They just decided to do whatever it is they wanted, thinking that the authorities would catch up with them, the legal authorities.
Well, that's the authorities. We're obeying a lawful order, quote unquote, lawful order from the President of the United States. And I think one of the ironies here, again, another irony, is that the law would catch up, meaning, but you can't pass what are called ex post facto laws, legalizing what was actually unlawful. And that's precisely what they did a number of years later when all of this started to come out. And the first inkling of it was a front page above the fold article in the New York Times that was published in December of 2005.
2005, 4 years after the fact. Tom, were you ever given any honest explanation for why you were targeted? You didn't reveal any classified information. You didn't go to the media. Yet the government came down on you like a ton of bricks. Did you ever learn why exactly they wanted to make you the scapegoat?
Yeah, I knew too much. I mean, I was in a very senior position. I was hired in from the outside. And it just so happened that given my position within the Signals Intelligence Directorate, you know, it's the primary directorate at NSA for collection and analysis and also production, dissemination of actual intelligence reports. And so I found out about all this, right? And I wasn't going to remain silent. You know, I would not have been holding true faith and allegiance to the Constitution if I just sort of let it go by. And I was actually a primary eyewitness to prima facie evidence regarding the violations of the Fourth Amendment, FISA, and what they called UCIT 18, which was the Bible at NSA that governed. It was a series of signals intelligence, basically the protocols by which NSA would conduct itself to not violate the Constitution and still collect intelligence. The irony of it, none of this should have happened. None of it was necessary.
No.
They still went ahead with it.
You're absolutely right. You know, you've just reminded me of something, too. Every national security whistleblower that I've ever encountered, including you, is able to recount taking the oath of office on his first day in governmental service, where we put our right hand in the air and we swear to defend and uphold the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And I always say that I hate to think back on that day and think that I was the only one in the room who actually meant it. Do you have the same experience?
You're giving me goosebumps, John, because I realized that I was the only one at the time. I did have other fellow, but they end up retiring and I was left alone. I was the only one that actually stood up. I was the only one that actually just said, I became a material witness for several investigations. I ultimately did make a fateful decision, but that was years later to go to the press.
Right.
But yeah, I was like the only one in the room. It's like, here I am. And here's what was surreal, John, is I found myself defending the Constitution against my own government in secret.
Yes. It's just Orwellian to think about it.
And it wasn't necessary. We didn't actually have to go off the rails or off the range. It was not necessary. We could have stayed within the ideals, and not just the ideals, but the principles of the Declaration of Independence, of course, as well as the Constitution, all the statutes. And if it really wasn't keeping up with the times, then you make the case with Congress.
You're watching The Whistleblowers. We're going to take a short break and then return to our conversation with the National Security Agency whistleblower, Tom Drake. Stay tuned.
Museums are important for preserving our history so that it isn't lost to future generations. But are physical museum spaces themselves a relic of the past? This is one of the best museums in the world, the Hermitage in St. Petersburg. Mikhail Petrovsky is the director here, and I bet he has some answers.
none of what is being spoken by the United States or by Ukraine is actually true. They're fighting a war essentially to prevent the return, the resurgence of Russian power once again in this region, and to ensure that that is postponed to the furthest limits as far as it is it's possible.
November 22, 2022. Outraged Orthodox Christians confronted Ukrainian security service officers, blocking entrances and exits to Kyiv's oldest monastery. They were looking for alleged Russian spies among the monks.
We имеем дело именно с религиозной войной.
The former reason for the brutal crackdown, one church's parishioners had sung a song about Russia. It's long been reason enough to condemn any Orthodox Christian, attack, imprison, and even kill them.
Наши враги, наши оппоненты прекрасно понимают, что не уничтожив православие, они не уничтожат Россию.
Есть места, которые соединяют землю с небом, а есть места, где соединение идет с адом.
Welcome back to The Whistleblowers. We're speaking with NSA whistleblower Tom Drake. I'm looking at the case of Daniel Hale, and there are other recent whistleblowers. Do you believe that there's been any progress that national security whistleblowers have made in the last 15 years or so, or are we moving backwards? You know, Daniel Hale received a longer sentence. Reality Winner received yet an even longer sentence, 5 years and 3 months, I believe it was. Do you think we're making any progress at all here?
The trend lines are not positive. The trend lines continue to extend out the punishment or the, you know, that's meted out on whistleblower, particularly if it's national security. The government literally does not take kindly to exposures of what I call state crimes. And it is a crime against the state to do so. And that's the conundrum. And the Espionage Act has become the go-to and other variants of it, the go-to to go after national security whistleblowers. The government also knows that there's no recourse to the court system. So they can retaliate against you and you really have no recourse. The channels are not protected. As I said earlier, they're really exposure channels. So unfortunately, anytime any kind of whistleblower, and there's been several over the years, there's always this huge cutout for national security whistleblowers. Mm-hmm. They don't get the same attention because the government clearly does not, you know, you would think that a national security whistleblower would be some of the most critical public interest whistleblowers of all the whistleblowers in the government, just given the nature of the secrecy system and the classification system. And yet, see, the word classified is sort of sacrosanct within the government space. So if they think you violated it, it's, you know, it's strict liability. So you can't even claim or pursue or present a public interest defense of any kind, and there's no current legislation that permits it.
Tom, there's a small handful of members of Congress. I'm thinking specifically of Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa, Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon, and Congressman Thomas Massie of Kentucky, who take national security whistleblowing seriously and often help whistleblowers who are trying to navigate this really very daunting and risky system that we have. What has your experience been on Capitol Hill? Why is it that more members of Congress aren't out there demanding that the executive branch of the government obey the law, ensure transparency, and respect the Constitution? Yeah. It just seems so basic.
It does seem incredibly basic. And my experience with Congress is, with a couple of exceptions that you've mentioned, are not willing to stand up for national security whistleblowers in particular because they defer to the national security establishment. Mm-hmm. Because they assume that whatever the government is alleging that could cause, quote unquote, in my case, you know, exceptionally great damage to the national security of the United States must be true. Why would they have charged you otherwise? And so it's an uphill battle, even with some of the voices you mentioned in Congress. My experience was not all positive. I had private conversations, even with Wyden's office. Mm-hmm. They acknowledge the reality of what even they're dealing with, but it's an uphill battle. And, you know, has been a longstanding member of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence.
The U.S. government has a whistleblower protection law, as you mentioned, but the national security whistleblower is notoriously exempt from its protections. When a national security whistleblower decides to report on evidence of waste, fraud, abuse, or illegality, he quite literally jeopardizes his career. What advice would you give somebody in the national security community who's considering blowing the whistle?
The first thing, they've got to get a lawyer. I mean, they've got to get a lawyer even before they blow the whistle. Just given my experience and others that have followed, it is crystal clear that the government thinks in any way, shape, or form that you may have exposed, quote unquote, national defense information, or sometimes it goes like the cover for classified information, they're going to come after you. Especially, and I would say there's an inversely proportional relationship between the degree to which they'll come after you and what the sensitivity is of the crimes and the wrongdoing that they have committed and have covered up mm-hmm. behind the secrecy system. Again, it's another one of those surreal things. And so you literally put your entire professional and personal life on the line.
Yes.
If you're going to come out. And remember, the vast majority of national security whistleblowers do so anonymously. They don't do this for fame. They certainly don't do it for profit. It is not some ideological thing. It's literally because, especially in the U.S. government, you took an oath. And if the government's violating the oath, I mean, you would think that there's a higher standard. You would think that standard is you can't use secrecy as an excuse to commit wrongdoing and then cover it up and then classify it and then hide it because oh, it's classified. So if you even reveal that part, that's also a violation. Mm-hmm. So it's a violation to actually reveal the fact that the government classified their own wrongdoing. And I remember the penalties, although in the executive order, are the same for overclassification or misclassification mm-hmm. or the abuse of classification. No one has ever been held accountable. It's only those like myself and others and you, right?
That's right.
Who have experienced the blunt end instrument of the government dropping the hammer of you know, these felony statutes on top of you. And it's extraordinarily difficult. My life has never been the same since. You know, I don't have a pension. I went into severe debt. Your relationships get all messed up. You know, it's like, what were you thinking? What were you doing?
Right.
Why did you do it? You're one person, right? So it's very easy for the government to isolate you from sort of the rest of society and turn you into a pariah.
Indeed. That's been my experience. And my experience, I know, was parallel with yours. What's the best way that people can help or encourage others considering becoming whistleblowers? You and I are of one mind when we say hire an attorney before you blow the whistle. Hire an attorney skilled in whistleblower protection before you blow the whistle. What other advice would you
give? Not just any attorney.
Yeah. Right. Go ahead.
Yeah, not just any attorney. And then carefully consider what the consequences are. Because even with the support of an attorney, and I ended up with a public defender, I had an attorney, but I ended up spending all of my liquid assets, pretty much all of them, went into severe debt just to pay for it. And that was before they indicted me.
Oh.
So I was left indigent. I was declared indigent by the court. I did not have sufficient enough assets to defend myself. And that means paying for an attorney.
Right.
And so I ended up, I had to cast my lot with the public defender's office, ironically paid for out the same funds that funds the Department of Justice. So ultimately it was the American taxpayer that was paying for my defense. Now, fortunately, I didn't end up in prison, but I came awfully close. This is something that people don't fully appreciate, how close I came to ending up in prison. And I think in part because I was sort of the first major case.
Yes.
The first whistleblower since Ellsberg. The government tried everything. There was all kinds of things they tried. I was also in Maryland. I was not in EDVA, which was a huge difference. And I had a judge who realized what was at stake and that I still had rights as a defendant, constitutional rights.
That's all we have for you today. We'd like to thank our guest, NSA whistleblower Tom Drake. I'm John Kiriakou, and this has been The Whistleblowers. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.